Hello and welcome to the IEA podcast. The episode you're about to listen to was originally featured as a video on the IEA London YouTube channel, but we've taken the audio and turned it into a podcast so that you can listen on the go. Enjoy.
Well, welcome everybody to this latest broadcast from IEA London. My name is Mark Littlewood. I'm the Director General of the Institute of Economic Affairs. And we have a great guest with us today to deal with an extremely important but very complicated topic. Neil Record is not only the Chairman of the Institute of Economic Affairs, he is the author of the IEA's latest research paper, which we have called The Great British Rake-Off: How Government Has Misled Parliament and the British People on Public Sector Pensions. Pretty important stuff, especially in budget week. Neil's report reveals that public sector pensions cost about £57 billion per year, more than is declared on the face of it. And to put that in context, that's more than we spend on the police and the Ministry of Defence. In addition to being the chairman of the IEA, Neil is currently chairman of Nuffield College Fellows Remuneration Committee. He joined the Bank of England way back in 1977 in the Economic Intelligence Department and moved on to other organisations as a currency manager. And in 1983, he founded Record Currency Management, a specialist currency manager. He's authored several papers on the UK public sector pension system. This is a real passion of his. He was runner-up in the 2012 Wolfson Economics Prize with an entry on the future of the euro. Neil, great to have you with us. Thanks very much for joining us for this broadcast.
Well, thank you for inviting me on.
So I want to break down the pretty staggering story that you've got to tell in your research paper, Neil, but I want to start from first principles. I think most of our viewers and listeners will know that public sector pensions are generally quite generous and generally very expensive, and that the taxpayer contributes a lot to them. But can you sketch out to us what we're really talking about when we're talking about public sector pensions? What are they? How are they financed? What do they feel and look like?
Okay, so let's start with the first definition. This is not the state pension. So there's a tremendous amount of politics around the state pension. There's the triple lock and the double lock and so on. And basically rounding, everybody gets that. I mean, it's contributory, but a little less contributory. This is not the state pension. We're not talking about that, so put that on one side. And by the way, the numbers there are also enormous. This is the pension for the people that work for the public sector. And that is just to sort of remind you who they are. It is all NHS workers, about 1.5 million of them. It is teachers. So they actually formally work for the local authority, although they're paid for ultimately by central government. It's the armed forces, it's the civil servants, it's the police, and all sorts of people sort of hanging off there. So in round numbers, it's about 5.5 million, slightly more than 5.5 million employees in a workforce of about 28 million, something like that. So it's sort of one in five, one in six, more like one in five, of the workforce in the UK. So that's the first thing. If you worked in the private sector 20, 30 years ago, in a reasonably senior role, so let's say the top, I don't know, half of the organisation probably, you would have been offered a thing called a defined benefit pension. So a pension which you made a contribution to, a few percent of your salary, the employer would make a contribution to more percent of your salary, and he would say, well, I will give you, as a pension from the day you retire until you die, a 60th of your salary, of your final salary when you retire, for every year you work for me. So if you worked for a private company for 40 years, you'd end up with 40 60ths, two-thirds, of your last year's salary for the rest of your life. Now, 30, 40 years ago, the retirement age was generally 60 for women, 65 for men. But a number of things have happened since then. One of the most critical ones is people are living a great deal longer. And with that and a combination of one other thing, which I'm going to talk about in a minute, it became very increasingly obvious in the 80s and 90s that these private pensions called defined benefit or final salary pensions, not dependent on investment performance, but a promise from the company, were getting very expensive. Very expensive, by very expensive, they weren't sort of 5 or 10% of salary, they became 20, then 30, then 40. And I've seen ones that are more than 100% of salary. So that means that every year that you work, if you're paid, let's say, 50,000 a year, your employer was having to put another 50,000 a year into a pot to make sure there was enough money to pay your pension when you retire. And so employers quite rarely said, this is completely unaffordable. So we're going to close these schemes either to new entrants. So that means if you join the company now, you don't get that. Or in extremis, and in fact, now this is almost universal as well, to existing, to what's called new accrual, so existing employees. So if you work for a company for 20 years, you built up 20/60 of your money, they then say, I'm so sorry, that stays as 20/60, so it's never going to be 40/60 from now on. We're going to give you instead a cash amount of money. And with that, you can buy yourself a pension. That's what happened. And that happened so comprehensively that I can't think of any private sector businesses, maybe one or two exceptions who still offer those. I think they've almost all gone. 99% of those have gone. And the replacement, just to be clear, is that companies typically would make a contribution to an employee of typically between 5 and 20% of their salary that would arrive in cash effectively, and the employee was then encouraged, allowed, and certainly given tax reasons to put that money aside into a pot, his own pot, his or her own pot. That money would then grow or not, depending on how investment performance went. And it turns out actually that 15%, an average amount that's put in, is wholly inadequate to produce a pension, anything like 2/3 of your funds, or even half of the fund salary on normal investment returns. So that's the sort of background. So these new pensions that almost everyone in the private sector has now, let's say 20 million people, are called defined contribution pensions. And it's that when people talk now about pension saving, that's really what they're talking about. So that's the sort of history. What happened in the public sector was this. So last thing I should say is about the private sector. In the private sector, when you paid your 15 or 20% contributions, which is a combination of the employer and the employee, it went into a pension fund. A pension fund is a legally separate pot, which is designed to survive if the company goes under. So the promise is funded, and actuaries come along every 2 or 3 years and say, is the fund enough to mean that if the company goes under, it can still pay its pensions? And the sort of mechanism by which all these pensions were closed, because they were, inverted commas, too expensive, was the actuaries saying, the fund is a bit too small. You've got 600 million in there, but you need 900 million. And the firm went, whoa, hang on a second. So the actuary was then forced by regulation to say, okay, you, Mr. Company, not the employee, need to put in £300 million over 10, 15 years, whatever it is. And that represents a very large amount of new contribution, which the company had thought it already paid. So hence the sort of mechanics of that. So public sector pensions are similar and they're different. They're similar because what they offer is what was used to be offered by the private sector. So actually until 2014-15, they offered exactly as I described, you know, a 60th or sometimes an 80th of your final salary, plus a lump sum and some widows and widowers benefits and various bits and pieces.
But each and every year that you've worked?
For each and every year that you worked, exactly. So you'd end up with between half and two thirds, between 40/80 and 40/60 of your salary is the period. Then came an independent review called the Hutton Review, commissioned by David Cameron in 2010. Lord Hutton was a former Labour cabinet minister, and he reviewed in full, I think probably at the behest, amongst other things, of people like me, who said, look, these public sector pensions are very generous, should we review them? And Hutton reviewed them and discovered they were indeed generous, but instead of reducing the generosity, he changed their nature, and let's describe this more as a seesaw. He didn't change the general value of the pensions, but he said, we're no longer going to have them based on final salary, but on average salary. Now, that means that high flyers, people whose salary go up very consistently and at the highest at the end of their, and much higher than their starting salary at the end of their careers, are particularly benefited by these sort of final salary pension schemes. So there's a, you know, the bosses got a lot of pension. And that people with low career, you know, the porter or the cleaner got a modest pension. So the change became, we'll do it on your average pension uprated by earnings inflation. So the fact you earn, you started your career on 1,900 a year and ended it on 42,000, you didn't really get those pay rises because most of that was inflation. Mm-hmm. So we'll average, we'll strip out inflation or add inflation back in, but we'll give you a higher percentage. So for example, I think the NHS was an 80th and now it's a 57th of your average each year accumulated over your full career, which is about 40 years now, 25 to 65. But it turns out that the values are almost identical to the value that it would have been. In fact, I think the specification was, how do we get to a 57th from an 80? It was the number that turned to be the same cost of these pensions. So,
okay.
And they're still there. And they're still, so when you join, you still get to join these. So what happens, but by the way, this is also important. The Treasury was asked by the government, and this is going back several decades, to be the pension fund. So the way it works in the public sector is you don't just work for the public sector. You work for an employer who is part of the public sector. For example, you work for an NHS trust. Yep. So let's just take as a large NHS trust. They're your employer in every sense. They're your legal employer. They're the people who, you know, you take to court when your infect is dismissed. Pay your PAY and so on and so on. They will ask you to pay a pension contribution. And on average in the NHS, you pay 9.8% a year in pension contribution. Imagining, I think, oh, that's good. I've contributed to my pension, so I'm going to get a good pension. That'll go off to the Treasury as the pension fund. The Treasury also ask the employer to pay the difference between what they regard as the cost of the pension each year, the amount you'd need to pay the pension, and the 9.8. And this year, that's about 20.5% in addition. So we're talking about sort of 30-31% is paid in total. That sounds a lot of money. And indeed, it is. It's about £50 billion a year if you take the whole of the public sector. So next question, what happens to that money? Is it real money? Employers, employees, and I know the money ultimately comes from the public sector, but just think of them accounting like a private sector business. It goes off to the Treasury. What does the Treasury do?
And I just want to be clear, Neil, that this is done every year. So
every year. £50 billion a year is paid each year. Each year it goes off because every year you accumulate new rights. Yep. And so if you work in the public sector, you get these rights every year. So what happens to that money? It goes to the Treasury, and this is the bit where we get a big departure between the public and private sectors. The Treasury does not save the money in a separate pension fund. It spends it. Mm-hmm. Gone. It just says, oh, I've got another £50 billion a year. That's great. I don't have to raise taxes. Or I don't have to borrow money. I just pocket it. So the government perennially, as we know, runs deficits, not surpluses. So what tends to happen is that contribution from these pensions reduces the deficit that they would have otherwise had, so they have to borrow a bit less money. But the government keeps a record of the amount that it owes because it's made all these promises. So think of it, you know, we've now got the Treasury, it's a pension fund. The actuary can calculate what it owes because of all these promises it's made, just like if it were a pension fund, but the money doesn't exist. So here's the rub. When you have a funded pension scheme, there is no getting away from the amount of money in that pot that went into this separate scheme, no getting away from that, and the amount you're going to have to pay your pensions. And with the passage of time, you can see how long they live and how much they work and so on. You can see there's going to be a gap because actuaries are quite good at forecasting how long people are going to live, you know, and they can see how much they earn. And that gap of money became very, very real because there may not have been a company to pick up the difference. That gap is kind of made up because there in the public sector pension, because there isn't a fund. So there isn't a fund. So the question is this. So this is a very esoteric point. If you invest money in a fund, it gets a return. It gets an interest rate or return from owning shares or property, whatever it is. So the fund rises in value. So you know, I put in my 15% or so, and I put it in this, it goes via the company, this pension pot, the pension pot goes up or down depending on market movements. So if you don't invest the money like the government does, what interest rate should you apply to say how big would the pot have been had we had a pot? And is that pot big enough to cover the liabilities that we owe? So let's guess an interest rate. Let's sort of find an interest rate. And you might say, okay, so here's the logic. If we are putting money aside and we're not investing in high returning but risky things like shares, what are we actually doing economically? We're not borrowing, because we would have borrowed that 50 million, but we're not, 50 billion we're now spending. We're not borrowing. So the interest return you should get on that notional pot is the interest rate at which government borrows money. That sort of makes sense. I know it's a bit topsy-turvy, but that makes sense. So if you apply that interest rate, you should be able to get to, you work back to say, well, how much money do I need to put in? So if you take the actual rate at which the government borrows money now, and something I haven't mentioned, all public sector pensions, and indeed all private sector pensions, are by law required to be index linked. That is, they go up with the RPI, well, these days it's CPI inflation every year with no cap. There's no double lock, by the way. It's not prices or earnings. It's a single one, it's prices. And therefore, the interest rate you have to apply is the rate you would get after inflation if you invested, if the government invested in its own. So the government issues bonds, things called gilts. So if you invest in gilts, and those gilts are index linked, which you can get some index linked gilts, what interest rate do I get from holding those? And that's the interest rate that this pot would get, because the government implicitly invests in index linked gilts because it didn't borrow them. I know it's complicated. Okay, so that rate today, that interest rate that you get from investing in index linked gilts is minus 1.5%. It's a negative rate. So that's very, very weird. So you put your money in and the money goes down, not up. The result of that is if you use the logic I've just described, the money you should be putting in or would have to put in if you were trying to do this as a standalone, it wouldn't be the 30% of pay, which I've described to you as the amount that the employee, the employee and employer of the National NHS Trust, not the 30% a year going into that pot, it should be over 60%, 62% of pay per year, to put enough money into this notional pot to give you what in fact they're getting. So which is certainty, index linked, and a very generous pension. So my argument is, if I had to replicate what the certainty, the security, and the value of the pension that an NHS employee or a teacher or a civil servant or an armed forces employee is getting, I would have to put in 60 or 70% of my salary every year for 40 years, and then I get it. Now, here's the gap. The government has chosen, and it started to do this 15 years ago, to use two interest rates in its accounts. So the rules I've just told you about, the interest rate you should be using, that notional rule, is actually a regulatory requirement for private companies. And in fact, it was the imposition of the regulatory inquiry which speeded up the abolition, the destruction of the private defined benefit pension scheme, because they were forced, they previously used very optimistic rates, or maybe we'll get 6% after inflation out of our equities and it'll be enough in the pot. And they actually said, no, look at the history now, we're not doing that. We're going to impose, and this was widely agreed by the whole of the OECD, which is all the developed countries, to use a thing called the AA bond rate, which is an interest rate which you get from investing in companies, not the government. It's a little bit higher than government rates, 1% or 2%. And it's a reliable rate that you could actually get. When you apply that rate, it's called the IAS 19, IAS, International Accounting Standard 19. When you apply that rate, that is now the law that says, if I'm a company and I want to say how much obligation do I owe my pensioners, you use that interest rate to do the calculation, and you also use that rate to calculate how much you would need each year as a percentage of their salary for the next year's accrual. So that last thing is called the current service cost, or let's just call it the pension cost. So why has the government been cheating? Because although it does report those numbers, the 62% of salary and the now 2.5 trillion of liability that it's got for its pensioners, it doesn't charge the employer, the NHS Trust or local education, doesn't charge them the 60%, which it should. It charges them only 30%. And it charges them 30% by using a completely made up rate. So instead of having this IAS 19 rate, this is widely regarded and indeed a legal requirement for companies, it doesn't use that. The scape rate is literally an artificial rate, which is decided. It's decided by a committee which I was involved with a decade ago, that the Treasury gets you around a table and say, well, what sort of rate should we should use? Should it be 3% over inflation or 2.5%? And there's a lot of argument about it, and they pick a rate. And they just redone in August this year, they've redone that consultation. And indeed, it was that consultation and the absurdity of the let's make up a number so we can make up the amount that the employers and employees are going to send us, even though it's all one pot. So changing that rate doesn't change the value of the pensions or the cost to the overall taxpayer. So last point, these pensions have not been funded. So instead of my money as a taxpayer in the last 40 years being put aside so I can pay my and my contemporaries' pensions, my money's not been put aside to be spent. I and all current taxpayers have benefited from spending that money without being taxed on it. So this very, very large pot of liabilities, which you can't get away from because these are your own employees, retired, index-linked, you can't inflate it away, are going to be paid for by the taxpayers of the future. So that's my children and grandchildren, lucky to have those now. And so this is also a massive intergenerational issue. And if you're in any doubt of how big it is, the total liabilities under the public sector pensions, not the state pension, the one I've been talking about, are now larger than the national debt. And we've been screaming about how large that is. I'll stop.
I want to unpick some of this and help me with it, Neil, because, okay, I get there's a big gap. I get that we've been, putting aside too little money for when our nurses and teachers retire, but B, then spending that money anyway, rather than even that being properly put aside. But help me with this, because money's also going out, right? Yes, we have nurses, but we have retired nurses too, who are presumably drawing down their pension. We have police officers, but we have retired police officers too. So some of the money's going out of the door to pay our previous liabilities. What I'm trying to get my head around is, when does the rubber really hit the road on this missing gap of 50 billion? Because it seems to me that the system, just to observe the world around us, is if you like, it's functioning. I haven't heard any retired nurse saying, I'm not getting my pension, what's going wrong? So when's D-Day? When's crunch point?
So there isn't a D-Day specifically, but we're getting now deep into the weeds of government accounting. There are two ways to account for government expenditure. And the government actually, helpfully, does both of these accounting for us. So it's not that we don't have to dig around. They'll actually tell us. And the two ways are what's called cash accounting. Now, that's the stuff in Parliament. Oh, this year we're going to get in £950 billion of tax and spend £1 trillion of tax. So it's a £50 billion gap. So that's called cash accounting. That's literally money in, money out this year. But that is a long way away from how a company would account for its year. So, for example, a company accounting for its year wouldn't just... So let's suppose you're a shipbuilder. You get a contract to build a very large ship for £100 million or £200 million. You might not get the money for that ship until the end of the contract, but you'll book over 5 years the £20 million a year, which you're paying that guys out. So it looks like the first 4 years, loss, and then massive profit in the last year. That's clearly not sensible because you've got the contract, you know you'll get the money, there may or may not be stage payments. But when the cash flows is irrelevant because you've got assets and liabilities. So the government also recognises that cash accounting in the modern world doesn't take account of any borrowing, lending obligations or anything to do with normal life. So they produce a thing called the whole of government accounts. Mm-hmm. And it's out of the whole of government accounts we get a really clear picture of the pension fund liabilities, the current service costs, and it's all very scary numbers. So 15 years ago, I wrote a paper called Sir Humphrey's Legacy, in which I claimed the government said, the public sector liability is 300 billion. And I said, no, it's 480. Well, and I put in a chart saying, and by the way, it's going to rise a lot. They went, yeah, of course it is. Well, today the government itself and the whole of government accounts is saying that its liability is 1.9 trillion on public sector pensions. And because we also know the interest rates they're going to apply for the next 2 years, it's going to be 2.5 trillion by the end of March 21. So we know that. So answering your question, Parliament really lives on cash accounting. It can't cope with whole of government accounting. And so until about 5 or 6 years ago, the money coming in from the contributions, which I was talking about, that, you know, the 9% from the, it was lower then, there was sort of 6% from employees and 15 from, but anyway, the money came in from public sector pensions was more than the money going out. So in fact, there was kind of no borrowing or not borrowing. They weren't accounting
for that. You could live on a day-to-day or year-to-year
basis. They were getting money in. They were getting 15 or 20 billion pounds a year in. Yeah. Oh, well, this is nice. And then, you know, we could all see it because actuaries and analysts could see that we had revenues going. In fact, they've gone up because now we put up the contribution rates. But the revenues, let's say, were flat. But the actual payments, the ones you describe people retiring, were going up and up and up, particularly because they're inflation linked. So every time we get a blip of 5% inflation, which we had, you know, we're going to get 4% now, and we had 5% in 2010, it goes up and it stays up. And so they crossed, the money in, money out crossed about 5 or 6 years ago. So it started to be a bit painful, but quite small sums of money, you know, maybe five, maybe 10 billion pounds. It's now, I think, about 15 or 20 billion pounds gap. So this is, I know, we're talking billions rather than millions. This is not big money in government. The point is that if we care about government borrowing, which we clearly do, oh, you know, we borrowed all this money and we worry about it, we should also care about borrowing from what is in effect the future, because we owe this money just as certainly to the pensions as we do to our international and domestic investors in gilts. And in fact, even more certainly, because two-thirds of all the gilts issue, this is government borrowing, are not inflation linked. Yep. So the government could, in theory, so this year, they're going to be worth less, 4% less in real terms than they were last year, and the government will find it 4% easier to repay them. That can't happen in pensions. And can you imagine if the government said 5 or 10 years down the road, oh, I'm so sorry, I know you put your money aside, and I know we promised the index-linked pensions, but we're not index-linked them. I think that's not... It's actually morally and contractually wrong, and I would not recommend that. I would be outraged if the government did that. It's got to pay these pensions, and it's got to pay them index-linked. So a bout of inflation, which was in fact a 30-year bout of inflation, which reduced our very, very high government debt at the end of the Second World War, which reduced in real terms from 250% to 40% of GDP our outstanding debt, cannot happen in public sector pension. So it's almost it's a less tractable debt and just as real. Now, when's the crunch? The crunch is every year for the next 70 years, every year. This burden is just going to rise and rise and rise, and there's nothing you can do about it unless you close the new accruals, just like the private sector pension has done, or close new entrants, that's the first thing. So if you join, you just get a defined contribution, or close new accruals. Or you could, I mean, this is, and I put this in the paper as an appendix, you could, if you want, transfer the whole thing to be fully funded. That sounds a bit weird, but you could quite easily do it without affecting anything. So you could put, you could take the 2.5 trillion, which will be at the end of March 21, you could put it in a pot and say that's what we owe, you know, IS 19 rates. We're going to issue a whole lot of index-linked gilts because the government can do that, and we're going to make them the property of this public sector pension fund. And that public sector pension fund, run by independent trustees, not responsible to government and can't call on the Treasury, they have to charge the employers what they think they will have to earn each year to keep fully funded the public. You can do that if you want. And that would increase apparent government spending by about £100 billion a year. It's independent.
Okay.
So
what I'm trying to work out here is why does what one might call this sleight of hand on their accounting and this gap that you've identified as £57 billion a year, essentially forever, if you like, why does it matter? Are you just sort of obsessed with the tidiness on an Excel spreadsheet? You said we're going to pay it, the money will be found somehow. Okay, now thanks to your paper, we know what the money is. But if we just transferred it and made it in some government document or other more transparent, none of the problem goes away, does it? Or, you know, I'm struggling with why the government isn't being upfront about this, because I'm trying to work out what the practical impact is of being upfront about it rather than burying away the true cost in Appendix 27, you know?
Okay, so let's start with people in work. Let's suppose you work in a sort of modest job in the NHS and you get 25,000 a year. I don't know, you're a porter or a cleaner, maybe. Just a number, maybe a nurse, 25,000 a year. and you have the offer of a job, a similar job in the private sector, at 27,000 a year, and you say, oh, I'm going to get some more money. Now, you need to make a comparison between the employment in the public sector and the employment in the private sector. And the employment in the public sector, you're paying 9% of your salary as a pension. You say, oh, God, you know, I get 25, but I only get 23 in my pay packet because I've got to pay 10% away. You know, I'm getting 27 and I get it all when I go work for the private sector or go work for the private sector. Now, that's a logical thing to do, and people are, as we know, you know, we believe in markets, which we do, people are very motivated by incentives and they're quite good at calculating. So if I said to this person, this employee, oh, you're not being paid 25,000 a year, you're actually being paid £40,000 a year. So 15,000 a year, or 60% of your 25,000, is going into a pension pot which you can't see, don't know about, and have no idea is there. But it turns out that when you retire age 68, or whenever it's going to be, you're going to be much, much better off than you would be had you gone to the private sector. And of course, this is interesting. That person might say, no, that's fine, I'll take the money now. And they might say, oh, I didn't realise it was so valuable. So we've now got this very so we're asking people to do a very complicated intertemporal comparison of money now, money in the future, their own personal discount rate, the rate at which they don't really care about the future or do care about the future is different from the one that the government's got. They can't really make the comparison. So it's not like for like. So the point is, you've now got a big gap between the comparison between money from the public sector and, you know, salary from the public sector, salary from the private sector. So, and this applies very, very widely. I mean, there are a few specialised employment. If you're an army officer, hard to make the comparison. It's hard to, unless you're going to be a mercenary, there aren't many jobs in the army private sector. But there are, for example, as a doctor, if you go and work in the private sector, and certainly as a nurse and care, all of, you know, there's a lot of choice, cleaner, porter, and so on. So I think, so let's call it the transparency of the labour market and ability to make decisions across your employer, very important. The other one is, we talked about intergenerational unfairness, that young people will just be bearing an unavoidable higher tax burden for something they didn't get and are not going to get. But the other one is the apartheid at retirement. So at retirement, this has increasingly become apparent. People working in the private sector will carry on working. They haven't got enough money to retire. They're, an architect, and they say, oh, I was going to retire at 60, but I've got enough money. And, you know, I'm pottering along. I've worked 3 days a week, and I worked till I'm 74, and, you know, it's okay. And I've just about managed. Increasingly, well, we've seen this from the doctors, they retire at 57. They say, well, my pension pot's now hit a new problem. The government's put on a limit on these pension values, and a lot of high-paid public sector workers have hit these limits. They're called lifetime allowances. I'm going to retire. I've got enough money, I'm paid two-thirds of what I... So their decisions are different, that we're actually removing a lot of able people from the workforce. And also, that doctor, retired doctor, is going to live a very, very, you know, good financial life. He's going to get a nice index-linked pension at Sirius. If he was earning, if he was a GP, earning 100,000 a year, which I think is the average, he'll get 60,000 a year index-linked for the rest of his life. And the equivalent in the private sector will have nothing like that, probably a fifth of that, even if they put in 15 or 20% in the pot. So we've got apartheid in retirement. Why? Why is it, you know, what's the sort of moral aspect of that? And the inability to compare salaries and benefits at the labour market while you're working.
So here's the simple solution, right? And what I'm struggling with is why the government or the trade unions or the employees themselves don't just grab this, that we start to advertise, I think your numbers are about right, a nurse's salary in the NHS, not at 25,000 plus benefits, but we advertise it as 40,000, parenthesis, be aware, £15,000 of this is going into your pension and you will only get it when you turn 65 or whatever. Why is there any reluctance, hostility, hold back in advertising it in that fashion, if that's the truth of it? And you would have thought for politicians who want an easy hit, that would be a rather great thing to do. Good news, nurses' salaries are now 40,000 a year, not 25. I know it's a slight hand, but why is there any obstructionism here? I don't understand why people wouldn't want to be transparent.
It's a really good question, because I can't answer that. I'm not a politician. I don't know what to respond to. But my instinct is this, that people's own valuation of future money varies enormously depending on their circumstances, their horizons, I think even their sort of education level. I mean, there's been quite a lot of surveys on this. So if you said to somebody, I'll give you £1,000 in 10 years time or money now, and they have a scale of, you know, at what point will you choose £1,000 and what point will you choose the money now? People will vary enormously between some people saying, I'll take £100 now versus £1,000 in 10 years time, depending on your circumstances, and you may need to because you may not have the money. And other people say, well, honestly, I'd rather have £1,000, particularly if you're in mixed link in the future. I really don't need the money now at all. I know I'll have less income then. So I think that decision about intertemporal decision making has enormous diversity of views amongst people. So if you said to your nurse, the salary is 40,000, which we're compulsorily taking 15,000 and putting in a pension, she or he might well say, could I have it in cash, please? And then I'll make a decision. And of course, in the IEA, we are likely to say, well, that makes sense. If it is in fact 15,000, if that the number is correct, I'm going on government numbers, so I'm to give you what the government has told me on their calculation, then why would the government mind? So it raises a very interesting question, I think, about sort of individual decision-making, because this is in effect a sort of planned economy. The government's telling you have to do this. And it's not clear to me in the modern world, when people may well have other means of support in their retirement. For example, many people, 65% of the population, own their own homes. Many people will downsize when they get to retirement age. They will use quite large sums of money that to pay what otherwise is their pension. It's a very efficient and reliable way of saving. So why put all that money aside? So I think this is a sort of an element of paternalism, which the government is imposing at a scale that most people don't understand. So I think if the government were to be more thoughtful about this, not sort of controlling or oppressive about it, to say, look, be open with the numbers and offer alternatives, I think they will be surprised about how many of their employees would say, look, to be honest, I can invest the money better than you. You're saying I'm going to get a minus 1% or 2% return on it, and that's terrible. Honestly, if you invest in the stock market, I can get more than that, or own a rental property or something. So I think it opens up. Now, why haven't they done that? I think public employment pay and benefits, I observe, are a lightning rod for industrial relations. They're still quite heavily unionized, and I think the relationship isn't relaxed enough and good enough for government to be able to have these conversations and offer this range of benefit alternatives. And I'm not sure government itself really understands the scale of the benefit. I mean, I think if you ask most MPs, I would say 90% of MPs, the ones that haven't read my paper, would say, they would be asked, what's the cost of public sector pensions? They say, well, hang on a second, let me just look up. It seems they pay about 30%. So they're about 30% of salary. Yeah, and I'm saying they're not 30% of 60. So that gap, and that gets the gap, by the way, between 30 and 60, which is £57 billion, just for the listener to understand that.
Okay. But it seems to me we might be onto something here, Neil, to really save a ton of money over the longer run. If your broad guesstimates and judgments are right about people's time preferences, you might well find a nurse saying, I'll tell you what, forget my £15,000 per annum into my pension. I'd rather have £7,000 a year now. You know, so you might actually be able to, over the long term, get the public sector pay bill down, right? That you don't need to necessarily give them all 15. So if you've got that if you want it. That's part of your contract. But if you want to cash it in now, you will be doing so at a much, much lower rate. And lo and behold, maybe we get a whole number of nurses who select £32,000-£33,000 today and no pension, rather than being locked into £40,000 every year because they've paternalistically got to have the pension.
Yeah, it's a fascinating suggestion. And if you think it through, I mean, I quite like it. I'm not a politician. I'm not going to do their work for them. But if you think that through, let's suppose the government probably doesn't want to pay the cash now, it probably prefers to have it borrowed and it doesn't hit their budget today. So let's suppose they say, well, I'll give you half of it now if you want in cash, and then you won't get the pension. So it is 33,000. So how does that then affect the labour market for private sector nurses? Well, the answer is it's definitely going to mean you don't get to have any private sector nurses at 27,000. So if you're thinking of a mechanism by which we could improve the pay packages in their efficiency, as you say, to give people what they want rather than paternalistically giving them something that they may or may want, not want in the future, it may mean one can then have rises across the board, because the private sector, in the case of, for example, nurses, the private sector is dominated by the public sector in terms of the positioning of the market. If the public sector was offering £33,000, you can guarantee the private sector has got to offer that or more. That nurses won't go and work in the private sector unless they're paid equivalently. Yeah. So that's a very interesting thought, because of course then you get ripples all the way through the economic system. And of course, us, you know, here at the IEA, we believe that the system is unbelievably complex and is best not managed by the gods on high, the planners on high, but managed by people's decision making. And the only way to make good decisions is to have full information. So this paper, so this peeling back the layers, is to try and get the most information that we know, and this is correct information, it's come from government, into the market, so that the market can then say, whoa, hang on a second, this nurse isn't paid 25,000, they're actually getting 40. So we at government are going to say, would you like a flexible package? And the employee may well say yes. I suspect large majority would. That then ripples through the market, and that pushes up the price of nurses, pushes up and their income, pushes up the income of care, social care workers, and may have all sorts of complex interactions. It also, in my opinion, has the benefit if we do reduce the scale, and indeed in both in benefits and in spread of the apartheid that we are getting in retirement, it would be good, because that's going to be politically quite explosive down the road, I think. We've still got quite a few people living on the old pensions from the private sector, which they earned 30 or 40 years ago. They're going to run out quite soon.
Final question for you, Neil. You say, quite rightly, you're not a politician. The IEA operates in the battle of ideas rather than directly in the arena of politics, but you talk to politicians. And this has been this latest paper from yours, The Great British Rakeoff. And for those of you watching on YouTube, or that will be in the show notes below, so you can click on it and read it. But when you talk to politicians, Neil, about this issue, what is your sense of it? Do their eyes glaze over? Do they just put their head in the oven and say, this is all far too complicated? Do they say, well, you might be onto something, but I'll consider it in 10 years' time. I've got much more on my plate at the moment. Do you think, you know, is there any suggestion yet that this is actually percolating through into the minds of our masters and overlords?
Well, all of those responses are ones I get. This is not new to me. So this paper was issued in October, the latest IEA paper, October 21. My first paper on public sector pensions, called Sir Humphrey's Legacy, which is a much fuller exposition of how the mechanics I describe the two now works, was issued in 2006. It was one of the papers that prompted the Hutton Review of 2010. But the result of the Hutton Review was not to reduce the generosity of public sector pensions, just, as I say, to sort of level them up. And that's fine. I think it's a perfectly sensible thing to do. The levelling up, that is. So I think a career average is a perfectly sensible way of doing defined benefit pensions if you're going to have them. Now, so I should say this. I'm funnily enough, I am actually quite a fan of defined benefit pensions. I think that most people find it very difficult to understand and accept market risk in something so fundamental, financial market risk. If they're investing in, you know, reasonably high yielding instruments like shares and property and so on, they're difficult to manage. There's all sorts of complexities associated with them. They can't really have the best information. The question really is the generosity of them and the extent to which people are prepared to put their own money into securing their futures. And these are personal choices. So I quite like the idea, in the longer run, that there was some sort of a scheme that for people who didn't understand markets, didn't want to do, could put their money in and get something like a public sector pension, but costed properly, so that there would be their own choice to put the money in and have it come out reliably index-linked at the end. So, answer to your question, I think undoubtedly this whole issue is in the too difficult box for politicians. You know, they are beset by issues, current, future and past. There are hundreds of special interest groups and constituents and tactics clamoring for their attention. And they live on the cash accounting you talked about. They don't really live on this accrual fund. So when I said, oh, we could do this reform, it wouldn't change anything, but it would mean it looks, it now appears you're spending £100 billion more than you should. Read the appendix to find out what that means. They looked at me and said, you're mad. And I said, well, no, I'm just, you would just be counting it as if you were a private company. So why would I do that? Well, they're not going to do that because it doesn't help them. So one has to remember for politicians that their job is to keep the electorate satisfied and content. And I think the proposals that you suggested, the ones that allow individual decision making for your salary, is a very, very good idea and would keep the electorate content and is a sensible thing to do and would solve many of the problems that I highlighted.
Well, Neil, thanks so much for joining me today. And thank you too for your paper. We'll also link to your previous paper, Sir Humphrey's Legacy, in the show notes below. This might be in the too difficult to deal with box for politicians, but the IEA, of course, exists to deal with the very difficult issues. That's our purpose on the planet. So thanks very much for your latest contribution to dealing with these difficult problems. And thanks too for explaining the nature of this problem and some of the possible solutions so lucidly. Been a real pleasure having you with us, Neil. If you've enjoyed watching, please hit the like button and the subscribe button below, and also the notification bell. That will mean that you'll be updated with all IEA YouTube content as it goes live. If after the budget you've got a few pounds spare, perhaps you'll consider becoming an IEA online patron. You can do so for just £5 a month. That helps us keep the lights on and produce this sort of video content. Again, details in the show notes below. Neil, been a real pleasure hosting you and talking to you about this thorny, controversial, but crucial issue. Thanks again for joining us. Thanks for watching. Over and out.
Thank you, Mark.